This is episode 472. Today you're going to hear a lot of things about ADHD, things that you've never heard before. And literally for 99% of you listening, I can guarantee that this is the first time you'll be hearing this stuff ever. In today's conversation, I speak with a naturopath that is one of the most educated people that I personally know in the world of holistic health. She's a polymath and goes extremely deep on this episode about why children and adult nervous systems are all of a sudden, in the last 10 to 20 years, hijacked beyond belief to the point that it seems no one can focus, everyone is unsettled and triggerable, and that we're all now snowflakes with no mental resilience. Today, we're going into ADHD, right to the core, why it happens, how to reverse it, and how to detox your body from the things that cause it. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Nice to have you here for today's conversation. First order of business, though, is that you should know this year, it's my mission to support 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean dealing with what's really weighing you down and not just the number on your scale. To look into what we do and how we do it, scroll down to the show notes or the caption below to book in a time to chat to me or someone on my team, and we can see if we're a good fit to work together on your weight loss journey or simply to help you to stop emotional binge and overeating and doing all those behaviors that lead to the weight gain in the beginning. All right, so I'm sitting here with Pia Kynoch, formerly appearing on episodes 363 and 389 of this show. Pia is a naturopath who spent nearly three decades collecting what looks like completely random qualifications: naturopathy, quantum biology, functional nutrition, qigong, breathwork, and really the entire package of holistic health education. She is quite the brain, and she's here to drop some of that knowledge on us today. So Pia, welcome back.
On you, with you, for you, around you. Yeah, this is a co-creation, everybody. I'm definitely here to share this space with you and to initiate this deeper conversation of learning. I felt like it would be a really great idea because we're going to be talking about attention and hyperactivity, impulsivity and focus and awareness is just to create a little bit more of that in ourselves in terms of attention, focus and awareness. And to do that, I'm just going to invite you to align through your posture. So I'm sitting down, but you might be standing up, or if you are moving around, maybe you could just pause just for a moment. And I'm going to take a breath, and it's almost like that breath elongates my spine, and I just feel an openness through my chest. So just noticing if you could also navigate a feeling of more openness and arriving through your own breath. And as you do so, I'm just going to invite you, if it's safe, if you can just look to a point in front of you, so beyond any particular object, and you're just going to softly defocus your gaze. So it's like you're staring beyond, I'm looking at a wall, so I'm staring at the wall, but beyond the wall. And I'm also just taking in my surroundings. So my gaze is starting to expand through the front, the sides, and the back. I'm engaging with as much of my awareness of this space as I can. The space above me, the space below me, the space around me. And in this defocused state, I'm just going to invite you to inhale gently and then double the length of your exhale. And you might want to do that one more time as you slowly bring your vision back to that initial focal point, and you might want to refocus on that and then refocus on what it was you were doing before, and then come back into an awareness of this conversation as we continue to chow down on the wealth of information that is related to how our mind and body system connect in a regulated, coherent fashion, or how it doesn't. So, I'd like to know, Maddie, because I heard you do that. Did you feel a little difference, a subtle shift just in your body or in how you're feeling?
Yeah, absolutely. I think whenever I do those kind of things, the first step is just that awareness or that beginning of self-observation that I noticed of like sort of stepping outside of myself a little bit and being like, oh, what's happening? Why am I doing that? Why is that itchy? Well, I haven't cleaned that up over there. Like, just the initial awareness of my environment that I've been just ignoring because I'm locked into work mode, and then feeling my body a little bit more, I guess, consciously.
Yeah. And definitely feeling our body a little more consciously is certainly a practice I love to offer and invite anytime, but particularly if there is attention and focus issues. And I feel like it could be really important just to start this conversation just with an awareness of how I really like to approach any thing that has been pathologized in our medical literature or psychological literature, or like a dis-ease or a disorder or a dysfunction. Really what I see it is a disconnection from an ecosystem, the ecosystem of our own body, the ecosystem of the world around us. So it's like our inner world and our outer world. There's some lack of coherence and connection and collaboration and conversation going on. And so when I'm looking to initiate or inspire some remembering of well-being and our own inner sense of power, presence is definitely part of that. But if you think about how we would clean up literally an ecosystem, say if we just use the forest as an analogy, some of the first things you'd want to do is take away the toxins. Like if there was actually toxins in that ecosystem, you'd want to take them out. But then you'd want to clean up the soil and make sure that there was enough nutrients and water and light and that there was enough air and movement. Yeah. Like that's how we regrow an ecosystem. And ecosystems, in recognition of it, like they are very dynamic. They're constantly evolving and they're changing. And sometimes there's a lot of composting going down at the bottom of the forest. Sometimes there's a lot of growth. There's different seasons. There's night and day and growth and death. And I feel like that's important to recognize that each of us are kind of going through that ecosystem journey, whether we're a little kid, whether we're a teenager, whether we're an adult, whether we've got a diagnosis with ADHD or something else, that our brain and our body are very, very plastic. They're very responsive and they are ecosystems that can be kind of cleaned up and nurtured and grown and evolved in new ways.
Yeah, I'm excited because of the stuff we talked about before we hit record, just about the way that you think about ADHD and ADD. And it really does feel like we're in a time where everybody is diagnosed. It's hard to know whether that's a symptom of our modern reality with screens, with light, with blue light or sugar, or whether it's also something that's happened in many areas of medicine, which is the expansion of the diagnostic criteria in order to sell more drugs. And I've done conversations on this podcast about cholesterol and that scenario and cancer and that scenario. And so I'm curious, or maybe a good place for us to start is just like, what's your thoughts on why we're here? Like, because it seems like the boom is like in the last 20 years, maybe in 10, like really, it's like out of nowhere. It's just like everyone's got this diagnosis.
Yeah, I feel like it is important to recognize that it is a business and it's a big business. Like they're heading towards a $20 billion trajectory by 2030. So in another 5 years or less than 5 years. And they have a growth trajectory related to that. They have marketing strategies related to that. There is, I think, over 40 million hashtag ADHDs on TikTok. So there's a lot of influencing going on related to celebrities and celebrity diagnosis or celebrity, I want to say the word admission, but it's not like I'm admitting I've got ADHD, but you understand what I mean, putting their hand up to say that's been part of their life. And so there can be, human beings have a very strong need to be part of a herd. And we also tend to think most like the information that surrounds us. And so if people are constantly accessing information that is basically saying, are you restless? Are you agitated? Are you feeling frustrated? Do you find it hard to focus? Are you really impulsive? You might need medication or there might be something wrong with you. Then I feel like it can be very, very easy for people to start pathologizing themselves or thinking that something is wrong with themselves. And as we've already spoken about before, the more time people spend on screens, the less aware they are of where their body is in time and space. For one aspect, so they actually aren't present in their own mind-body system. So that makes us feel disconnected from our own roots, our own foundation. Then we're also accessing a light source, which changes all of our nervous system chemistry and the rest of the rhythms in our body. We cannot activate the same sense of coherence when we're surrounded by devices and artificial light exposure. That's definitely true. And there are many more studies coming out now related to not just artificial light exposure, but even non-native EMF exposure. So looking at electrical items, basically, in electrical networks, human-made electrical networks that impact gestational development. So when the baby's growing in the womb, if the mum has a lot of device exposure, that is actually impacting baby growth, neuronal development, and will impact potential ADHD trajectory over the course of that child's life. And we're in a sea now of Wi-Fi exposure. We are in a sea of electrosmog. We've got satellites above us and Wi-Fi towers all around us. And it can be really challenging for our human body to navigate that if we also aren't spending very much time outside or in natural light. So I would absolutely agree with everything that you said. And there's so many conversations that we could open up into, but I felt like it could be really great. Maybe if I shared, I wrote a list. I'll just show the people who are watching on the screen. I use my little whiteboard because I really want to bring a few things into particular focus in our conversation today. But I also just kind of want to illuminate the complexity of ADHD and why I'm not a huge fan of long-term medication. I feel like I'll just briefly speak into medication. So most medications are stimulant-based, but there's also non-stimulant-based. And what the stimulant medications are looking to do is to increase particular activities of the chemical messages of our nervous system. And what that is neglecting is that full ecosystem picture. And I feel like if medications are used with the purpose of creating new habits, new thoughts, new beliefs, new actions in a life where you're really working to restore your own ecosystem and your own harmony and your own balance, that's amazing. But if the medication is just being given as symptomatic relief, then it's other symptoms are going to appear over time. All medications have got their own side effect protocols, and stimulant medications actually suppress your own awareness of your appetite, like how you nourish yourself, of the water coming into your body, how your body can move information around is going to be hampered if you're dehydrated. So, you know, that's just the first kind of little bit into medications, and that's not what I want to focus on, but just as an insight into the fact that medications are really being supported as a solution, but they're certainly not the only solution. And so some of the things that I like to look at is, and what not many practitioners seem to know about, is that, say, lead exposure. Lead is a heavy metal. It's been around forever. They've used it in all sorts of ammunition and wars around the world. They used to use it in house paint. It's been in cars. It's been in many industrial products. It's been in cosmetics. Like, lead pollution is basically everywhere, and some bodies, like some human bodies, will pick it up more than others. Lead accumulation is found basically in every case of ADHD. The more lead accumulation there is,
wow,
the higher the neurotoxic level. Yeah, wow, but not many people know that.
No, and not every. Like, I'm surprised with the word, like, it's a part of every case.
Well, look, I'm never going to say every. N equals one every time in terms of studies of the human body. But as far as the research that I've looked at, if all of the studies for lead are correlated to ADHD symptomology, there's that, and that's it. And so there's other, and so I'll also just describe that how it can be passed down through generations as well. Obviously, the egg that created you and the egg that created me was carried by our mother, but that was also carried within her grandmother's womb. So lead exposure can come down generationally through the female lineage as much as it can come through in our own individual lived life. If we grew up in a house in Australia, and I'm pretty sure New Zealand this is true for too, that was painted sometime before like the mid-70s, there would have been lead in that paint. And if there was, I don't know, heaps of lead car batteries around that leached into the earth that you were playing in as a kid, like, that's how easily it can come in. But when a woman is pregnant, if she doesn't have enough calcium through her diet, the body will take calcium from her bones, to give to the baby for its growth trajectory. As calcium is taken from the bones and passed to the placenta, lead will come out of her bones at the same time and move into the placenta and move into the fetus. And so the mum has no idea that's happening. And so that's why you wouldn't know that. And so the only way that you can really test for that, you can do hair mineral testing and other sorts of testing, but looking at lead exposure, or anyone that might have concerns, that might be true for their family, or they know that it's a concern in their area, or their dad or their mum was a painter, or there's a few different things. But mercury
And not that long ago, leaded petrol was a thing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I remember filling up the car as a kid with leaded petrol.
Yeah, and I used to really enjoy smelling it as a child.
Same. Sorry. Maybe we needed extra stimulation.
Definitely. I mean, I tick every single box for every single ADHD symptom. I'm letting everyone know that now.
I got tested when I was a kid, actually, before it was cool, but they just assumed that I was just curious, really.
That, and so, I mean, the other thing about pathologizing ADHD, why I'm not a fan of it, is that even say if someone's got lead exposure, it does change the pathways in our brain. It doesn't mean that you're less intelligent. It just means that you have to activate different areas of your brain. And in fact, that's potentially why some people with ADHD are insanely creative and very innovative and can link very abstract concepts, because their brain is not neurotypical, it's neurodivergent. Like, it does activate, not the same as most of their peers or most of the general population. And so maybe some of these neuroexcitatory or neurotoxic impacts in some odd way are still allowing us to develop and still reach our own potential. We're just doing it via a different pathway. We don't all need to be the same. We don't all need to be the sum of all the averages. It's just whether it is disabling us and creating dysfunction and disharmony. That's when I feel like it's really important to address. And my childhood and my young adult years, I mean, I just was so unhappy inside of myself. I mean, I was high functioning. I was doing lots of things, but my depth of unhappiness inside myself was very profound. And that's what I would like to ensure that other people don't need to live through. And if we can find different ways of managing our own presence in ourselves, then I feel like happiness generally flows from our own presence. So just looking at things like heavy metal toxicity can allow our body to not be so toxic, like our ecosystem. There's less toxins in the forest, basically. And it just means that our soils are actually going to have the nutrients to help us to grow and develop. Whereas if we've got lots of lead or mercury, and mercury can come from fillings, it can come from fish, it can come from vaccinations, it can come from medications. Like, there's a lot of different things. Aluminium also is a big one, come from all different sorts of products and including vaccinations. They know that can change neurodevelopment, it can be neurotoxic. Things like fluoride exposure. So fluoride's in our general water supply, our municipal water supply. There's no safety data on fluoride in water. So fluoride on toothpaste, yes, like applied to teeth directly, has been shown in a small way to reduce dental caries, like the holes in teeth. But fluoride, we're not meant to ingest fluoride. And that's what's been in our water supply for a very long time. There are many more studies now coming out showing that it has dangerous levels of neurotoxicity, and that it can really impact our pineal gland. And our pineal gland is what's listening to cues of light, for those who did listen to previous episodes. But our pineal gland helps set up our sleep rhythms and our detox pathways and our repair pathways at nighttime, because it's releasing melatonin, our hormone of darkness. And so imagine if any little body or a bigger body had fluoride exposure that was chronic for them, was constant, and it started to build up in a little gland inside your brain, and that gland then couldn't work the same way anymore. Well, that's what fluoride exposure partly can do.
You said something before which I thought was just worth looking into, or at least I wanted to comment on, was that we don't need to all be the same. And I feel like one of the consequences of pathologizing everyone that's a slight deviation from the normal numbed out Westerner, that's high on sugar, high on screens, high on everything, that's kind of brain dead. And I'm obviously being satirical a little bit there, but it's like any deviation from that, and you've got a bit of character or a bit of energy or a bit of testosterone, whatever it is, there's got to be a medical label for it. And it's like, and I'm thinking, I heard a thing the other day by one of the AI whistleblowers that was talking about the concern for the entire globe soon having one voice, because it gets its data from one source, one server. And so I feel like I'm using that as a bit of an analogy, but like, our government's trying to get us to be one bland, boring personality and everybody else is sick. You know what I mean?
So a lot of our educational systems, though, that's what they're doing their best to do, to conform a child, a preschooler, and then a child, and then a teenager into a set model of education. And not everyone learns the same. Every person on the whole earth knows that. If some people don't, if I tried to give you verbal instructions of how to find my house right now, some people are like, oh my God, you just said a lot of words, but I've got no idea how to get to your house. I could give some people visual instructions and that might work better. Some people, I draw them a map or create some feelings around it. Like, we all learn in significantly different ways, and none of that is addressed or met in our schooling systems, generally speaking, because there's not the training behind it, there's not the budget behind it, and potentially there could be some conspiracy theories behind it in terms of modulation of the way people think, how they behave and how they conform, and therefore then how they work and support economic structures without being disruptive to the businesses that have made the most amount of money.
Yeah, which is interesting because it seems like a lot of very successful people fall into this category of hyperactivity and brains working a little bit differently, and maybe there's something to that, right?
Well, that's true. And there's also a lot of very, very unhappy people. There's very high suicide rates in undiagnosed ADHD. There's high traffic accidents. Like, there's a lot of different things that go on in a very dysregulated system, which is why I like to create these conversations about how we can create regulation. And so I just want to drop into some of the other things that I like people to know about as influencing factors before we move into some deeper conversations just around the biomechanics of the human body and development over time.
Let's do it.
So like I spoke about some of the exposures, like the heavy metals are huge, and the lead one particularly, I really want to stamp that into people's awareness, the fluoride as well, but also like just the plastics and endocrine disrupting chemicals. And I really want to highlight here fragrances. I have a really, really big issue in my tissues with the fact that not many people are aware that synthetic fragrances completely disrupt a human body's hormonal profile, messaging profile, its sense of safety in the world. So I'm talking about synthetic fragrances like perfumes, deodorants, in washing products, so it stays on your clothes, even when you hang out clothes that have got perfumes in it on the line. Like, once you're not in a perfumed arena anymore, your sensitivity to synthetic fragrances becomes very high, I guarantee. So my sensitivity is very high, but there's fragrance candlesticks, there's fragrance candles, there's air diffusers that people plug in and have emitting fragrances all day, every day. This is toxic to the human body. It is toxic to the development of a child. I cannot highlight this enough. So fragrances are really, really, really unhelpful. If they're synthetic, they are unhelpful. Our body was not designed to work with synthetic fragrances, nor was it designed to work with synthetic colors or preservatives or synthetic flavors. So once humans started getting there and making chemicals that aren't natural and then applying them basically to the human body from skin through our air, so through all of our different sensorial passages, that started to become a problem for the body, and more chaos is signaled in the body. And it's really hard for a little body, particularly, it gets harder for adults too, but adults do learn a measure of self-control over time. But little kids, if they're in an environment that's got a lot of signaling like fragrances or plastics exposure or light, artificial light exposure, or maybe they've got a little bit of lead in their system as well, boom, like that's already just a lot of challenges for their little body. So if we can just take away the synthetic fragrances and start calling out companies that are using it. I recently contacted Echo Store because they purport to be very environmentally aware, but they still use synthetic perfumes in their laundry liquids and dishwashing liquids. So I emailed them and I wasn't very happy with their response, but they said that they're working on it and I left it there. But they said that your voice matters and I appreciate that. But each person, when we do use our voice, the more people that use their voice, all of a sudden it goes from a smart to a big shout. So yeah. I like bringing awareness to some of these impacts. So plastics is a really big one. I haven't used a microwave in 15 years. I do not agree with microwaves. I also view earbuds as microwaves for ears. So if a little kid is using earbuds or if an adult is using earbuds, you've got a whole lot of signaling that is basically creating microwaves for your brain. So as well as impacting melanocytes, like light receivers or electromagnetic frequency receivers that sit in your ears, like the cells of your ears. Once you lose them, you don't have them anymore. And that's, again, a problem for longevity and quality of life trajectory over time. So I already spoke about the non-native EMF, like the human-made device exposure. A lot of clients that I've looked after that are struggling with self-regulation also have a lot of smart home devices. So lights that talk to each other, or fridges that you can set, or just different things that you can talk to via Wi-Fi.
Alexa and Siri.
So again, if possible, if you can minimize any of those things, basically I like to describe it, it's as if everyone just pretend that I'm over at Maddie's house right now, but I'm a really annoying little voice. And I'm like, Maddie, I'm over here. Maddie, actually I'm here. That's kind of what these little Wi-Fi devices are doing to our nervous system. Our nervous system knows that they're there. It's an invisible signal. So we're not taking any notice of it through our like conscious senses, but our unconscious senses have to respond and handle that information. And if it's constant, if you can't get away from it, again, imagine if you're a little body. Like that's so hard. It's so exhausting, and it's exhausting for adults. And if you talk about how overwhelmed and disconnected our adult population is, well, there's some pretty easy reasons as to why. And if we can start navigating a new way of reducing some of those Wi-Fi exposures, our body just gets a little more rest. It gets a little more space to be more of itself.
Yeah, in this house, we turn it all off at nighttime, but as much of it as can be is hardwired as well, so that there's less floating around the air. And I think as well, we're in the world of convenience and being able to buy Alexa and just speak to have your questions answered from the couch. Mix that in with when you talk about deodorizers and scents and smells for the bathroom and for the house. I think of like going to a grandma's house where it just smells like perfume or potpourri or whatever all of the time. And in my family, I'm always banging on. I'm like, you got to get rid of these. They're wrecking your thyroid. They're getting in your brain. Like, and everyone's just like, oh, Maddie and his hippie opinions, like as if these would be sold if they're unsafe, that generic view from people. What do you respond with when people say that stuff? It's like, these things wouldn't be sold if they were so dangerous.
So the regulation capabilities of our governments around the world are mainly related to profits, and often the safety data is related to studies that have been engineered by the companies that are selling the products themselves. And it doesn't actually take too much research to have a look at conflict of interest. And it's something that I've looked at for many, many years. Conflict of interest drives basically our globe. And so it's very, very hard to reconcile the fact that our governments are aware that many of their policies, many of their regulations aren't actually keeping our population safe. And it's not until the data becomes fairly overwhelming that things change. And so for quite a while, I've been saying that 5G towers are really not helpful for human health. And quite a few people have had a crack at me on social media, but the studies that are coming out now are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And there are a lot of European countries that take these sort of regulations more carefully than it seems Australia and US governments do. And they have stricter regulations around that. They also have stricter regulations around preservatives and colours in food and additives in food. And so, look, it's coming. And for people who choose to remain not curious about it, I think that's a silly, well, I don't want to call anyone silly, but when we remain rigid, when we remain rigid in our capacity and awareness of understanding, I mean, I think rigidity often leads to breaking. And we're going to break when we realize that what we've been holding on to for a long time just was old news. And the whole point of being alive is to continue to learn. And when we bring a lens of curiosity, and not to say that someone's wrong or right, but it's like, well, what is it that I don't know? And they were the questions that really led me on to study more and more and more and more. Like, what is it that I don't know? That was interesting. And what else? And so the more that I've learned about our human body, we are electric. We are magnetic. We are light beings. There is light receptors in every single compartment of our body, from our skin to our eyes to our hair to our ears to our mouth to our lungs to our heart to our gut to the middle of our brain to even more parts of us that I haven't even mentioned yet. Every single part of us has a relationship to light. It has a relationship to electricity, and it has a relationship to magnetism. If you ignore that and you just believe that walking through a modern life that basically is very electrical and very magnetic in terms of all of its device exposure, and there's a huge amount of light, then I find that really interesting that you wouldn't want to be curious about the impacts of that on your DNA.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what a sort of quote or phrase that really sums up how these companies and governments operate is, it's better to ask for, to say sorry, than to ask for permission. That saying is like encapsulates why these things get so far down the road and why so many people have to be unwell enough to then kick up a fuss enough that's big enough and loud enough that it actually gets heard, and then policy gets changed. It's like, that's sometimes decades.
Totally. Well, as I mentioned, no safety data on fluoride, and that's been in our water for a long time. There is no long-term safety data on 5G, and that has just started being rolled out across countries and will remain in our lives, hopefully not too long, but I would imagine a while before the data comes out stronger and stronger and stronger. But also, what about mRNA vaccinations and the world of pain that many people are in? Someone sent me an ABC article this morning saying cancer rates in 50 and under are going through the roof now. And I believe that there's relationships between this and all the things that I'm bringing up, including the last couple of points that I just mentioned.
I'm 100% on board with you.
So, yeah. So, and these, and also the stress that people are now under, I do want to talk about like the epigenetic changes. So ADHD, if we keep bringing it back to this original conversation, has what's called a high hereditability, which means that it can be passed on in families. So when I'm looking at hereditability, so genetics is one aspect, but what they know about genetics is that our environment loads the trigger of what genes are expressed. And to explain this a little more clearly to people who don't really, like they've heard the word genes, but they don't really know about it, we've got to say about 22,000 in each one of our cells. Every single one of our cells has got the same genetic code. So how do my brain cells know to be brain cells and my liver cells know to be liver cells and my heart cells know how to be liver cells? They have differentiated and they've come together to work in a coherent organization. And those cells know what they're doing. They know which bits of the gene code to read at different times. Now, there's a few things that can come and interfere with the reading of that gene code. So the gene code is basically like the protein factory that builds our house, the house of our body. We are mainly made of protein, fats, and water. Water is the structure that holds us all together. We actually are mainly made of water, but I won't talk about that right now. But these protein building blocks, they need to be given the right message to be like, right, I need more roof tiles over in apartment 1A. I need a new sink in apartment 1B. And so our body is receiving all of these different cues the whole time. When people are heavily stressed or if they have exposure to toxins, that can change what genes are read. If they've got nutrients in their body, too much or too little of some nutrients, that can change what genes are read. So we've got the same gene code the whole time, but which genes are expressed across our lifetime depends basically on our environment. It also depends on stress levels related to not just physical stress like the toxins or the mechanics of our life, but emotional stress and mental stress. And now put your hand up if you've grown up in a family where there was some mental stress or emotional stress, or you didn't feel like you lived in an environment where you received all the resources that you need or the presence that you needed. If you didn't feel really seen, heard, fully valued, or where there wasn't enough time to sit down with you, or if everyone was really busy, or they were always on their devices, or just no one really cared enough about what was going on for you. That's super common, yeah? And that means that we also get messages in our body that shift which genes are expressed. And until we take responsibility of our own presence within ourselves, until we give ourselves that lens of I see you, I hear you, I feel you, I receive you to yourself, that really also makes it very hard for gene expression to change. And that's why, again, I'm going to bring it back to this ecosystem conversation. If we can clear out the toxins, so if we look at helping address like what nutrients are in that ecosystem, like your own building, then we can start bringing along things to help your foundations feel like your own, to really ensure that sense of safety, connection, belonging, and presence is available to you, in you, for you, around you the whole time. That changes the expression of who you are. You feel safe to create. You feel safe to innovate. You're not just erratic and making rash decisions and unable to really focus on things that fill up your cup. You don't really know what you're doing if you don't feel safe. Like you just kind of, you are kind of running around and you're reacting to life rather than responding and co-creating with it.
Do you want to know how to lose weight without counting calories or needing to use restrictive diets? Turns out the answer is on Instagram. You might be interested to know that over 70% of our paying clients begin their journey with a weight loss goal. Most of them achieve this goal without fad diets and without calorie counting. And in the process, they also rewire their brains to stop craving sugar, and they stop their secret binge eating sessions without the need to use loads of willpower. Why does what we do work? Because the fat that you want to lose, it isn't just about the calories you're consuming. It's actually wild how differently we do things. We work on your mind and your body gets better. And I think more people need to know about how we can do this for you too, which is exactly why I'm back on Instagram. as The Real Weight Loss Coach. If you want to know how to really drop the weight that's been holding you down, how to keep it off, and to stay healthy long into the future, then follow me on Instagram. The link to my profile is in the show notes below, or you can search for me on Instagram by typing in The Real Weight Loss Coach. Give me a follow and I'll chat to you in the comments and the DMs over there. So if I'm understanding the analogy, it's like if we clear out the toxins, it's likely that we're able to achieve a level of stability of which we've not, mental stability or cognitive stability that we've not previously experienced due to those toxins like lead sending us down our neurons down a different path.
Well, just, yeah, so toxins can also be light. You can have junk light. You can have junk food. You can have junk interpersonal relationships. So yeah. toxins are quite a few different things. And also I like to bring in here, like, human bodies are rhythmic. Everything in our body is rhythmic, like our heartbeat, our brain waves, like everything in our body is actually waves and we work to all these different rhythms. And so what music are you listening to? What kind of TV shows do people watch? Are kids in front of screens a lot? What noises are they surrounded by? Is it something that you feel like or believe would create more harmony or disharmony? Because that's also what's shaping our body's sense of if it's toxic or if it's nutrient-based. And so life is all around us. And so even though we might not directly be bringing it in through our mouth or through the placenta when we were growing in the womb, we still are taking in and bringing in our life experience the whole time. So I just, if we clear out the toxins, then we can create some stability and then we can really hone in on the nutrients. And so when I'm honing in on the nutrients, that can change genetics or epigenetics. So things like MTHFR, people might have heard of before, but that's mainly related to things like folate and B12 as nutrients, and zinc and B6 are really important for pyloria. That's another condition related to ADHD. Iron metabolism is vital for all of the different factors related to neurotransmitter synthesis and bone growth and a whole lot of things related to ADHD and inability to sit still as well. But I want to come back to the MTHFR, for instance, through toxins in the diet. So folate, synthetic folate or folic acid, sometimes it's called, is now added to our food chain. It's a little bit like fluoride was added to our water. So synthetic folate or folic acid has been added to our food chain, and in no way is it the same as natural folate that we find in leafy greens and nuts and things like that. So the consumption of synthetic folate, you will see it across every brand of cereal, every brand of bread, anything that has added flour that's not organic or added wheat products that's not organic will have added folate with it. This synthetic added folate completely changes your one carbon metabolism, it's called. And it basically means it changes your ability to make neurotransmitters, to detox effectively. So if you've got things like heavy metals inside your system, it's going to make it really hard for them to come out, or detox other things that life presents you with. If you don't have the right neurotransmitters, it's really hard to be present. It's really hard to feel like yourself. And so that is so ubiquitous through our food chain now. Or like, is everywhere. That's what the word ubiquitous means for people who haven't heard that before, but it's everywhere in our food chain now. So you add things like the fluoride in our water and this folate in our food chain, and just those two things is pretty huge for a growing body. We can be born with a marker that means that we already, in our genes, that means that we already have an issue with folate metabolism. That's what the MTHFR polymorphism means. So there's something that's kind of switched one of the genes around that means that we have a lot of trouble with synthetic folate. Like, it's hard for our body to process it properly anyway. Synthetic folate comes along and completely shuts down that path. And so this is, again, where I'd be looking at toxins. And a lot of people wouldn't consider breakfast cereal like a toxin, but it could be for that individual that I might be looking after. If I felt like they were struggling to make neurotransmitters or struggling to detox, I would be looking at removing synthetic folate from their pathways.
Yeah, I had that conversation a lot with people in general during Yali's pregnancy in regards to the difference between actual food folate versus folic acid versus folate fortification in foods. And yeah, got a lot of eye rolls, obviously. But
no, it's deep.
And as usual, those eye rolls come from people who are not educated in nutrition whatsoever. It's just this idiot's going against the mainstream narrative.
Well, I mean, I see that as a rigid person that has forgotten that curiosity is what creates a great life. The more, and actually, I'll just share this for people who haven't heard of Ellen Langer before. She's a Harvard professor. She's been in the game for like 45 years. She has been a trailblazer woman, PhD researcher for one of the top educational institutes in the world. And so she studied psychology deeply and mindfulness in people, not mindfulness as if I'm sitting down and going in it into a yoga pose. Mindfulness is in how much curiosity can I bring to this moment and then to this moment? What is it that I don't already know? How much more could I learn here? I wonder how many more opportunities to enjoy this moment there are. And it's an interesting thing with my clients with ADHD, when I bring in curiosity-based exercises, it can really help them stay more focused on what they want to do. Because as soon as their brain decides something's boring, they automatically lose the presence of their body. They're kind of projecting out into the future or they're ruminating in the past. They're not really in the present moment. Whereas curiosity brings you very presently into the moment. So it's really helpful, you know, for treatment kind of protocols. And it's really important to live your best life. Imagine if you came home to your partner and you're like, I wonder what 5 new things I could notice about their body today, or about their hair, or about the colors that they've chosen to wear, or about the way that they look at me. When we bring that level of curiosity to something that we already think we know very well, it allows us to drop our assumptions, our biases, our old predictive perspective, and allows us to open up into a whole new world. And it's very, very powerful to allow dreaming and fun and lightness and playfulness to move in.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that viewpoint. I'm more inclined to just call them a dickhead.
I just feel like that blocks conversation. It's also kind of rigid.
I mean, there's nobody that listens to this podcast that doesn't agree with the idea that modern medicine has some degree of rigidity.
Oh my gosh, I'm with you. Totally. I mean, I've been called woo-woo enough times. It just is water off my back. Other nutrient that I want to just briefly speak into as well is seed oils. So obviously the omega-3 to omega-6 ratio is very skewed now in our modern world, but the impact of seed oils, again, ubiquitously used across all food items, even food items that I used to buy that came with olive oil previously now come with a seed oil, not an olive oil. So reading labels and pairing back your foods to only have really good quality oils and really reducing seed oils will also go a long, long way. And to explain why, when I relate it to nervous system, our nervous system has a lot of cells that are communicating both in the nervous system and all around it. Yeah, our nervous system is our main communication portal. Every single one of those cells has a cell membrane, and that cell membrane loves omega-3s. It doesn't love an excess of seed oils. Seed oils change its fluidity, its ability to move and conform and change shapes and create receptors and have a healthy interface between other cells and itself. And that's a big problem for a body, particularly a growing body. So seed oils is another one that I want to kind of highlight. And then as a child gets older, obviously they're starting to chew. And it's important for kids to have soft foods. But as soon as they can move into hard foods, and this is very true for adults, if you eat too many soft foods, you will change your jaw development. You'll change the communication in your body. Soft foods are also what I consider, if that's the majority of your diet, that's basically toxic to our system. Our body is just like, what? What's going on? It changes the way it absorbs and utilizes in our body, and it can spike blood sugar. But it's a lot to do with this mastication or chewing signaling here that then creates deformity basically through the rest of our body. We are designed to chew. So I want to highlight that too.
Well, I feel like a good example of the deformity that many of us have experienced is that we need to have our wisdom teeth extracted. That's a sign that the size of the skull and the jaw has declined or fallen inwards, because those teeth once had space. And in some people's heads, and like my giant head, I've never had a wisdom tooth removed because I've got enough space in this enormity that I carry on my shoulders.
Well, great. This actually leads me into disordered breathing. And so I have a very narrow palate, and I have had 4 teeth taken out, and I had I don't even know what it's called, but an orthodontic device that helped me move my bottom jaw forward because I had an overbite.
Oh, I did that too.
And so that means I do have significant TMJ issues, partly because of that and partly because of a whole lot of things. But my tongue doesn't have a lot of space to suck back on the palate of my mouth. Now, the position of our tongue in our mouth is a signal system-wide for our whole body related to our stress response. If it's relaxed and kind of sucked back on the palate of our mouth and it has plenty of room to kind of sit there comfortably with the edges of the teeth, you will be much more able to easily access your parasympathetic nervous system than if it doesn't fit in your mouth properly, or if it's on the floor of your mouth, if it's on the bottom of your mouth, or if your tongue is tipped up into your palate in a strong way. They are all stress activation signals. So our tongue position and what's happening in our mouth is actually setting off the rest of our system. Our brain actually has a whole lot of real estate prescribed to our tongue. Like, our tongue's very, very important for where our body understands where it is in time and space, how safe it is, how it's communicating literally to our internal world and external world. And if you think about our mouth, it's the portal into the rest of our body, yeah? And this is also related to breathing. Disordered breathing is absolutely related to attention and focus and energy and anything that could be related to ADHD. If kids are, or adults are breathing through their mouth preferentially and not their nose, they are going to have issues with all of those signs and symptoms. If they are breathing through their nose, so I've got a deviated septum, I've also got little nostrils. So these are the things I would look at for a child now. Do you know what I mean? I would look at, you can get special like OTs, like occupational therapists or neuroanatomy functional kind of therapists that help expand palate regions now for little kids, but also making sure that the breathing is working really well. So reducing allergies, making sure airflow is really good, sleep is really good. Circadian biology has so much to do with how we sleep. So if artificial light exposure is excessive or at night, a child or an adult cannot sleep as well. Their respiratory function will change. It much more likely leads to mouth breathing over nose breathing. And then your whole body will be in a sympathetic or stress response state that makes it very hard to heal, repair, develop, grow, and evolve. It will keep people more rigid, less curious, and acting more like assholes.
I tell you what, I'm in a situation where I'm lucky that I work in this world and I'm very curious as well. And so, but as you're talking, in the back of my mind, I'm like, yes, we're doing that with Gabriel. Yes, we're doing that with Gabriel. Yes, we're doing that with Gabriel. So I'm like over here being like, we're on the right path. This kid's got some hope of not us not messing him up too much.
Yes. Yes. And so then the next things that I think that we can unpack a little bit more now is this retained primitive reflexes that we see in ADHD that not a lot of people know about. So we can talk about primitive reflexes. And I like to talk also about cervical or neck instability. This can also be a big thing from, it could happen in utero, but say if the birth was traumatic or I don't know, lots of different things can happen through childhood where there might have been a little injury to the neck. If that's not picked up early, just a little bit of dysfunction through the upper regions of the neck can really change the communication through the back of our brain stem. And I really want to highlight the back of our brain stem. So if you're listening to this and you feel like it, if you just kind of cup your hand around the back of your head, you know, where the top of your spine basically meets your skull, in that section of your brain, there is so much signaling from the whole rest of your body basically comes up through the back of your brainstem, and even signaling through your mouth, your nose, your ears will also travel and traverse through the back of your brainstem. It's just our eyes that have some special functions that go directly into the middle of our brain.
So this feels nice.
It does feel so supportive, doesn't it, to hold the back of our brainstem. I haven't even let go of mine yet. I know, I'm kind of leaning my head back a little bit as I'm talking. And so this back of the brainstem area is huge for signaling for the rest of the brain. And so if there's any dysfunction through the neck or if there's any postural collapse, like if I'm sure that we've all either ourselves or seen it in another person when they're very sad, upset or angry or depressed or really not themselves, their shoulders will curve in a little bit. They'll collapse through their midline, or if they're on a screen, you see it every time, they will be looking at a screen and getting down and lower and lower. Their neck position comes lower and lower. I mean, our head turns into a massive weight the more our head posture is forward, but that crunching through the back of our brainstem completely changes our body's sense of safety basically in itself. All of those postural signals, that change in breath rate and heart rate and the squashing of our whole abdominal area, will be sending messages up through the back of the brainstem going, hey, I'm not really that comfortable, I don't really feel that good. And it changes which parts of the rest of the brain we have access to. So our brain connectome, you can think of it like a huge wiring system, really gets led onto by this first portal of connection through the back of our brainstem. And so if the back of our brainstem is sending messages going, not feeling that happy with my posture or my breath rate or my heart rate right now, if they're really slumped over and I'm just not feeling that good in the skin that I'm in, you can't really access your prefrontal cortex, like your decision-making, your impulse control, your sense of awareness of self, your sense of social connection and grace and ease and flow in the same way. It's just not possible. And so I like to do a lot of work around kind of awareness of the back of the body. Maybe I'll send people off to different practitioners to look at cervical stability, because if they've got any dizziness or vertigo, if they're not sleeping well at night, if they've got poor posture while they're sleeping at night, if they're not breathing well, it could all be coming from the back of their brainstem or their neck region. Did that make sense?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that made so much sense. And it's funny too, because as I've referenced, we've got a little bub here at the minute, and obviously head stability, neck stability is huge. We're always managing that and putting it in positions to be able to practice that kind of strength and postural sort of practice. And so, yeah, it's just interesting to hear you talk about this and think, oh, I'm actually managing someone's posture all the time.
Yes, and we're managing our own posture all the time. So I've got, when I'm working with these concepts, I've kind of now settled onto, I really like looking at, I'm just going to call them pillars, because sometimes I don't know how to classify the work that I do or the way that my brain works. And so I kind of like looking at bio light. So we've spoken about light a little bit, but then I like looking at biomechanics, and that's what we can talk about now. I like looking at the biochemistry, like the nutrient profile. Like if someone doesn't have enough tryptophan, they're not going to be able to make enough phenylalanine or tyrosine. They cannot make the main neurotransmitters that help them feel good and have focus and concentration, let alone the omega-3 ratios and all the other stuff. Then I like to look at the bioelectrics of someone, the biofield awareness of someone, and then the biowater of someone. And when it comes to the biomechanics, it's like your body is like the moving map of where your mind knows it is. And so if you're not really feeling really connected to your body, then where the hell are you going on your map of life? This is why a lot of little kids, a lot of the ADHD signs and symptoms, they're really showing a body that doesn't feel very safe in time and space. And so it might be their fascia is really tight or really rigid. Even from in utero, we're receiving signals from the mum for our fascia development with her heartbeat, her tone of voice, her sense of safety in her body. All of the different things that happen in that maternal fetal diet can kind of set up our body for whether it thinks it's coming out into an environment that's stressed or safe. And so our fascia is what's called piezoelectric, like it literally conducts signals and helps create energy in our system through pressure and stretch and movement. And so babies are obviously doing that from the time of birth in small, subtle ways initially, but then they're doing it more and more and more over time. So they're going to be learning more about their interoception, like what's happening inside their bodies, their proprioception, like where they are in time and space, like what their joints and the rest of their bodies are doing, and sensory motor integration. And so this is where I want to talk about the primitive reflexes. It's like the body's original neural software. So it starts developing in the womb. The brain and the skin divide from the same cell lineage in embryonic states. And so our skin is really, really important over the course of our life. And I'm a skin therapist also. And I really love to highlight to people who are feeling really stressed how much a little skincare, a little touch, massage for babies, it's really important. For kids, it's really important. For adults, it's really important. Touch really does signal a lot to our body when it feels safe in that touch. So reorganizing a safe sense of touch can be really, really powerful. But the original neural software that develops in the womb is designed to help the baby leave the womb space and already know how to do things like suckle, or to know to look for, like they'd be kind of moving their head around and moving their lips around looking for a nipple. So that's pre-programmed into their nervous system that already starts developing. That's like common field knowledge, basically, that our genetic DNA blueprint has inside of it. And so there's a few other early developmental things that will already be happening from birth onwards, or it starts growing in utero onwards. They are meant to kind of leave the baby and become more integrated and develop into more highly skilled kind of techniques. They don't stay forever. they have to mature. That's basically what I'm trying to say. So when a primitive reflex integrates, it's making way for the new intentional movement patterns. So we're moving more from the back of our brainstem, like that's, you can call it the more primitive. It's not necessarily primitive, but it's just accessing our mind-body moving map. And the more intentional we are with our movement, the more we're accessing more parts of our brain, reaching all the way up into our prefrontal cortex. And so if something delays or disrupts this reflexive process, that could be chronic early stress or trauma or the cervical instability that I just spoke about, or if they're really tight through their fascia, maybe they did think that they were going to be born into a really stressful environment and their vagal nerve development wasn't that good. They might have had croup, or they maybe they got an infection, or maybe they were born early, or maybe they were born late. I mean, you could add in lots of different things there. Maybe there was just different levels of inflammation. We can call that. Maybe there was some underdeveloped postural tone, like muscle tone. And sometimes that can be due to nutrients, but sometimes that can just be due to a lack of movement opportunities in early childhood. And sometimes some families just aren't aware of how much time a kid should spend on the floor, or how to set up an environment that's really safe for the child to be on the floor, or just to have the time and the capacity to be really present with the child. So sometimes kids' physical needs are taken care of, like the food and the shelter, but the emotional needs of someone being very present with you aren't there. And so can you imagine if you're a little baby, if you're on the floor, you're very vulnerable. So if someone's not being very present and attuned to you, it's going to change how safe you feel in your movements and your curiosity and how you integrate that. That it's the integration that's really, really important. And in fact, if they're not fully integrated, what can happen over childhood, teenage and adult years is these primitive reflexes can literally reemerge when we get really stressed and overwhelmed. It's kind of like we go back to basics. We go back to this kind of stage of our lives where we're like, oh, yeah, I never actually kind of got beyond that because I never really felt safe enough to. I kind of developed it enough, but whoa, it's still really present in there.
Can you give some examples of what you mean by primitive reflex? Because I feel like that sounds like a bit of a textbook terminology, sort of. Like what's the behavior as a baby that matures and what does it mature into, so that we can all sort of be like, oh, I do that, or I know someone that does that.
Okay, so you would know that a primitive reflex is retained. Say if someone had a really strong startle response, like a really overactive startle response. So that's called a moro-reflex. And so that person or that baby or that child, that adult, would be overreactive to sounds or light or touch. They could have panic attacks come up, just emotional hypersensitivity, like a poor stress tolerance. There's something called the asymmetrical tonic neck reflex, ATNR, or there's a symmetrical tonic neck reflex. And so what you'll notice is that there's difficulty for that body in kind of crossing midline. There will be poor handwriting, poor grip control. Sometimes if you turn the head, other body parts will move, or an arm might move, which obviously if you were handwriting, that would be really hard if you're trying to concentrate and look at the teacher or whatever. And trouble tracking with the eyes. Sometimes that could be really subtle, but you know, if you were asking someone to keep their head straight and track with fingers all the way out to the edges of their peripheral vision, then come back through midline and then go to the other side, sometimes you'll just see the eyes skip a little or just not really be able to follow. They literally can't follow those finger movements. Like they're trying to, but they can't. So that's signs of retained primitive reflex. A big one that you'll notice in ADHD, particularly for the squirmers, is something called a spinal gallant reflex. And it just means that they've got hypersensitivity around their lower back or waistline. And so there'll be a lot of fidgeting. They'll be uncomfortable either with their clothes or with the seat that they're on. They don't want to press back against the seat. It just makes them kind of go, ugh. And it's not super conscious, but they just really struggle with things kind of touching their back or being on their back, or if someone else was to touch their back.
Does that relate to injury susceptibility as well?
I mean, it does, because your postural control is challenged when you have unintegrated primitive reflexes. Mm-hmm. You just don't have the same strength, stability, and surety in your body. That's why they're retained, because they haven't developed into those higher awarenesses of self and ability to really fully control it. And bedwetting beyond a typical age is also related to that spinal gallant reflex. And if you talk to a lot of people who've had ADHD, or ADHD, like symptoms, signs and symptoms, bedwetting is pretty common up until older ages. I mean, I don't know how old I was when I stopped, but I definitely was wetting the bed beyond kind of five. Like I would have been, I reckon, going up to nine, and it was very stressful. Like I got into a lot of trouble for it. And yeah. I mean, this unintegrated, again, I tick all of the boxes for these things. I also just want to let people know that I have completely transformed my being, my life, my...
wet the bed.
Yeah, I no longer wet the bed, which obviously I get invited more places these days. there's definitely some beautiful things that evolve in life when these integrate more fully. But why I'm saying that is just because sometimes people can be like, oh, yeah, I identify with all of these things that we've spoken about so far and I feel really overwhelmed. I just want to say it's more to be like, oh, if you can be curious about it, I wonder what else I could do to help my body or support my body. Or now that this has just been spoken about, I can understand that I've got that as a sign in me. Amazing. I can work with someone like a functional neuroanatomist or an occupational therapist or another person who's trained in retained primitive reflexes, and I can retrain my body to a deep foundational level. And from that level, I will be fundamentally different in my approach to life. I'm going to feel so much safer in my body. There's the palmar grasp reflex as well. You know, when I'm sure you have this with your baby at the moment, Maddie, but when you hold out a finger, they'll really grab onto it and they can grab pretty hard or hair even.
Yeah, pulls Yali's hair, tries to rip her nipple off. That happens. Yeah. And I'm just in here working and I hear this scream and it's like, he just tried to rip my nipple off. But he really stabilized emotionally and physically when he's got hold of your finger.
Yes. I mean, this is partly like nature intended for all of these processes. Like there's a reason behind every single one of these. And obviously when parents or a parent has the capacity, and I'm not judging anyone for not having the capacity. You might have been born with all of these things yourself and then you've had children and then you're like, whoa, I can't even feed myself properly or have a shower, let alone do all these other things. And so being really present with the child is what helps that child feel safe enough to be curious about what's next. Yeah. They can make mistakes. They can explore. They've got a safe base to come back to. They're not being judged. They're not being told that they're a dummy because they can't walk yet. You know what I mean? Like there's patience, there's kindness, there's compassion. And I mean, obviously if we didn't receive that in our childhood, being able to offer it to another person is a learned experience. So there's the also, what else was I going to say about the palmar grasp reflex? Oh, so that leads on to fine motor skills. And so if people have got challenges with dexterity or writing or even letting go of emotional experiences, that palmar grasp reflex could be part of it. Right. And the last one I'll mention is the tonic labyrinth reflex. So that's when poor balance, you know, clumsiness, also motion sickness. You often hear about ADHD signs and symptoms being related to motion sickness. People can have it quite severely. That can also be related to that other condition I mentioned very briefly, pyloria, B6 and zinc deficiency or imbalances. But fear of heights, and it's partly because when they look down, they're not sure what's happening with their body and they feel so unsafe because there wasn't enough practice of the integration of the tonic labyrinth reflex. So that means that there's difficulty judging spatial relationships. And in my opinion, that means that sometimes there's difficulty just judging relationships. So all of that just means that there's going to be much more difficulty with sustained attention. There's emotion lability, like when you're quick to cry or quick to rage, you're just quick to lose it. There's that poor impulse control. Maybe there's shifts in speech or language. It might be too fast. It might be too slow. There's anxiety in busy or loud environments or complete meltdowns in those environments, poor coordination, poor clumsiness. And so the brainstem is where these primitive reflexes lie, which is why I like to talk about cervical instability, posture and breath. When we're really aligned through our posture and when all of our abdominal organs have got literally room to move, that change is signaling through the back of the brainstem. And that's really, really helpful as an adult or a teen or a young child, just to really support those feelings of safety and to help the expressions of those reflective circuits that don't require conscious input.
Yeah, that's talking to you, every time I talk to you, I just want to like pause my life and go and sign up for 43 different education courses and degrees, basically. Like, I love just how deep your knowledge is and the eloquent way that you speak about it, because I find it inspiring. And like, I need to learn more. I want to know about this. There's stuff I don't know. Oh my God. If you want to know more about what you don't know, talk to Pia.
I mean, I think I can't remember what you said at the beginning, but I did have a little giggle. She's learned like so many different things that none of it makes sense. And so, I mean, I was offered a lot of judgment sometimes when I was studying things. People would ask me, why on earth are you doing that? Like, what has that got to do with anything? And I'd be like, I don't know. I just really need to know it. And I try not to blow people's minds too much. Like, there's so many different ways we could have taken this conversation today. Like,
totally.
I wanted to talk about light signaling inside cells, but I was like, you know what? We've got to start somewhere. Why don't we just start with some of the biggest stuff?
So because you're amazing and obviously I think you're awesome and everybody else listening does, and the other podcasts we've done are totally worth listening to. So everybody should go and listen to those next. But where can anybody that's listening find you on the internet?
Go to www.piakynoch.com or just find me on Instagram at Pia, the spiritual naturopath. Ask me questions, send me feedback. I love it. If you want me to talk about a particular topic, I will. And I will be running another ADHD class pretty soon. And I'm currently working on building a practitioner training. You might like to join that, Maddie.
Maybe.
So that's exciting in my life.
Yeah, amazing. And to round out, as we normally do, what is one piece of health information that you wish more people knew about?
You are the ecosystem and you are the one that can build the forest or the tree or the flower or the sky or the waters that help you grow your best life, for sure.
Oh, I love that. I want to like some kind of applause. That was amazing. Well, thanks so much for being here. Thanks for sharing your wisdom and knowledge with everybody. And yeah, I'm sure plenty of people will reach out. And of course, we'll do another one soon.
Amazing, Maddie. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Bye. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.